The theme of this sort of series is looking at the Dharma through images and symbols and stories and myths. For the last few weeks, we've been looking at the Buddha. We've been looking at the Buddha, the Buddha as a symbol, the Buddha's life, and some stories of the Buddha's life. And the last, we just started looking at gestures, mudras, what are called mudras that the Buddha are shown with, sort of symbols of the Buddha. So last week, we'll backtrack a little bit. So the Buddha is very much the symbol of enlightenment, the symbol of the enlightened mind. But there's lots of different facets. Enlightenment's got lots of different facets, lots of different characteristics, which can be symbolized, which are often symbolized by showing the Buddha with a number of different gestures, or what are called mudras, M-U-R-D-R-A-S, mudras, each of which says something about enlightenment. So last week, Vajratara talked about the mudra, the gesture of fearlessness. So she talked a little bit about the fact that enlightenment, if you like, conveys fearlessness. Spiritual development short of enlightenment also just reduces our fear, reduces our anxiety. We get a sense of ourselves as something bigger than our own sort of little body, our own little ego, our own little world, which is all very fragile. We become something about something bigger, to the extent, as it were, that we step outside of that very small vision of ourselves. We step out of the fear that it engenders, because, I mean, our little ego, our little body is very fragile. And if we're sort of fearful that the world won't do what we want, well, the world won't do what we want. So, you know, fear comes with a package, really. So enlightenment sort of bestows fearlessness, and it allows people to bestow that fearlessness to some extent on others. So we looked at that last week, gesture of fearlessness. And this week we're going to look at another mudra, another gesture. The mudra of meditation. So if you look at a lot of images of the meditating Buddha, not any that we've got here, you'll see that he's holding his hands in a specific way. He's holding his hands like this. On his lap, as it were, like this. And that's the mudra of meditation. So they're not just sort of in his lap, any old how. They're in a specific sort of, it's holding them in a specific gesture. They're in a specific form that has a specific meaning. So what I'd like to do tonight is explore that mudra a bit, what it conveys, and also how what it conveys can help us in our practice, our own practice of meditation. So mudras are a sort of body language, if you like. They're an expression. They're expressing something through the body. And as with other body language, when we take the same position, we experience something of what it expresses. This idea comes out, I think, in various forms of yoga, for example. But it doesn't have to be esoteric. It's very obvious from our experience. If you want to feel down, well, try slumping. Try having rounded shoulders and frowning a bit and letting your neck go down. It's very effective. It's a really effective practice for feeling down, actually. Or if you want to feel sort of up and alert, well, try standing up and alert and have good head and shoulders. Get your shoulders sort of open and, you know, and you'll feel that. Try smiling if you want to feel something. Or we could take it a bit further. If you want to know what it feels like to be a particular person, don't do this when they can see you, because they might think you're taking the mickey. But try just really watching them, and then do like them. Do like that. Walk like them. Hold your head like them. Gesture with your hands like them. Copy it. And then you'll feel a bit what it feels like to be that person. Actually, much more effectively than just thinking, oh, well, he's a bit sad and he sits on his energy a bit. Behave like somebody who's a bit sad and sits on their energy a bit. And you really feel what it feels like. Copy the body language and you'll get the flavour of it. Something else, say if you wanted to know what it feels like to be Spanish so that you can speak Spanish. Well, try being a bit Spanish. Try being a bit more expressive. Touch people when you talk to them. Put some energy into your demeanour. It's a bit of passion. And know a bit more what it means to be Spanish. Get to speak Spanish a bit better that way. Otherwise, you always sound like an English person talking Spanish. No hablo muy bien. So if you want to feel like, if you want to know what it feels like to be more Spanish, copy the body language and gestures and expression of somebody who's Spanish. If you want to be more enlightened, if you want to know what it feels like to be more enlightened, copy the body language and expression and gestures of a good seated Buddha image. If you want to know what it feels like to meditate, copy the body language and gestures of a good Buddha image. Really look at a good Buddha image, good seated Buddha image, and feel what it expresses. Get that sense of what does it feel? What would it feel like to be like that? And then sit. We sit ourselves with that, with some of what that expresses. A good Buddha image can be a visual meditation class. If we use it properly, it lets us feel our way into what it would be like to meditate like the Buddha. What would it be like to feel like that? I mean, we've actually got a Buddha image there, which nobody can see, but I'm going to refer to it anyway. Down there behind Gary. Frank still can't see it. What does it feel like? Well, I mean, very often you really... That one, you get a real sense of groundedness. You get a real sense of groundedness. Look at the ground. Have a look at it later. Look at the groundedness. Look at the hands. You get a sense of uplift. You get a sense of the head held high up, almost in the heavens. You get a sense of wholeness and completeness, calm and serenity. There's a sort of really serene facial expression, a smile, the sense of being in another dimension given by the aura. So you get all that. But that's all translating it into words. That's all translating it into words. And it's not about words. It's about feelings and direct experience. It's about what you get from actually feeling your way in and then acting what it feels like. So the Buddha image can be an object lesson in meditation. It helps us imagine the meditative state out there and then sort of bring that into our own experience in here. Incorporate it into our own experience in here, in our direct experience. So, well, I mean, I suppose for a start, I'd like to encourage you to think about that a bit and maybe think about using the Buddha image in that way. Use that great symbol of meditation to connect with meditation. Maybe do some research. Look at Buddha images from different times and different eras. Especially going beyond the rather conventionalized sort of late Tibetan ones that we tend to sort of see a lot of. Look at the Buddha in art books on the internet. We've got some art books in the library. Have a look at some of them. Look at the Buddha. There's a book called The Buddha Book, for example, which gives some examples. Look on the internet. Really look at them. What do they express? What do they express? And bring some of the feeling of what they express into your meditation. Even buy a Buddha image, maybe. You really find one that speaks to you and have it where you meditate. Or imagine the Buddha in front of you when you begin to meditate. Imagine what it feels like and then connect with that, connect with what that expresses. Imagine the Buddha image in front of you as you meditate. You can sort of and then bring some of that feeling. Connect with what it expresses. So the whole Buddha image directly says something about meditation. And that's also true, bizarrely, of the mudra. It's true of the mudra, the gesture of meditation that the Buddha is often shown with. So I'd like to explore that a bit. So what does that gesture convey? What does that gesture express? As usual with a symbol, I mean, you can't just sum it up. It'd be really easy to say, oh, it expresses this, or it expresses that. As usual with a symbol, you can't just neatly express it in words, because if you could, you wouldn't need a symbol. You could just express it with words, and that would be a lot easier. So you have to sort of find a way into it from several different angles. You have to sort of approach it from several different angles, and different people might experience it in different ways. So for me, I can only say how it impinges on me. For me, one of the things it illustrates is a certain sort of completeness. So the Buddha is making us... Oh, I was doing it that way, it's the wrong way around. But I don't think it matters which hand is on top of each other. You're making a circle with the hands. Circles are very much a symbol of completeness. You're also making a circle with the arms. There's a sort of sense of completeness, of being one unified whole. There's not bits sort of flying off in all directions. There's a sort of unity about it. Which is also, to some extent, expressed by the cross-legged gesture. There's a sense of unity and wholeness. And this unity and wholeness is one of the fruits of meditation. It's one of the effects of meditation, a sort of unification of our different energies, unifying the different parts of ourselves, bringing them together so there's a lack of inner conflict. We're all running in the same direction. We're not in conflict with our different parts of ourselves. So we get this sense of harmony, of unity, even of peace, of calm. And also a lot of energy, because there's a lot of energy tied up in warring parts of ourselves, which we can free up. So that's one of the things that it just brings out for me, is that sense of completeness, that sense of a round whole. Wholeness, harmony. So maybe that's one aspect. But another is that it looks as though the Buddha's holding something, doesn't it? It looks as though we're holding something in the hands. Something invisible. Maybe something very, very fragile, like a bubble. Just holding something very, very fragile, very, very gently. So in our meditation, we could try to feel what it would be like to hold something very beautiful and very precious and very fragile in our hands. What it would be like to hold something very beautiful and very fragile in our attention. And I'll come back to that. It's sometimes also described as though we're holding the universe in our hands. We could imagine holding the universe in our hands. So if we could imagine, if we could use the image to connect with what it would feel like to have this sense of holding the universe, all of space, all of those stars, that incredible sense of expansiveness in our mind, if we could really use the gesture to connect with that, then we might get some of that real sense of expansiveness that can be a feature of meditation, that sense of loads of space all around us, this oceanic sense. So that's something we could use it for. I think that is also brought out by that picture. If you have a look at that picture, there's something around the head, which is just this sense of like expanding into space, expanding into the universe. But another way I relate to the mudra, and I think this is what I'm going to talk about most, which has got to do with the idea of holding something very fragile and very precious and very beautiful, is that it expresses the way we need to gently but firmly hold the present moment in our attention when we're meditating. The present moment is very precious and beautiful. But it's also very fragile. We need to hold it with a sort of appreciative attention, resting our attention on it in an appreciative way. That's not too tight, because that would just damage the thing. We wouldn't be there with it. And nor too loose, because then it would just be gone. We'd just forget it. We're drifting. Lose our mindfulness. So this way of thinking about the image as holding the present moment, if you like, holding this very precious thing, the present moment, in our attention, couples up with a couple of areas we need to think about in our meditation practice. And one is the really crucial area of balanced effort, that we often talk about as balanced effort. And the other is the equally important thing of the nature of our effort and the nature of our attention, that it should be kindly and appreciative. So one of the aspects of learning the art of meditation, because it is an art, is learning how to feel your way in to the sort of effort we need to be making when we meditate. On the one hand, we do need to make some effort. We do need to make some effort. We need to make some effort to keep continuity of awareness going. And I'm going to talk about, particularly about the mindfulness of breathing, because it's easier. But I'm going to sort of talk about it in those terms. But so we need to make an effort to keep continuity of awareness. We need to make an effort to keep that sense of observing our experience, rather than just being caught up in it and swept away with it and swept along with it. And we need to make an effort to keep awareness of what's skillful and what's not, so that we put energy into what's skillful and we just let what's not skillful go. Otherwise, if we don't make any effort and just see what happens, if we don't do any effort and just see what happens, we end up doing what is sometimes called the just drifting practice, which I think at one point the Mugger Banks had dubbed Hindu neutral. It's a bit of a slur on the Hindus, but anyway. The just drifting practice. Just daydreaming practice. Just falling asleep. Just phasing out. Just getting angry. Just thinking about what to make for dinner. Just whatever happens practice, you know. So we need to make some effort in meditation to stay with the practice, keep continuity of awareness, nurture what's skillful. On the other hand, too much willful effort will stop us dead, or stop us meditating. I don't know, I can't do it very well, but there you go. I really got to focus on this breath. There's not a second of this breath is going to escape my attention. Well, I don't know. It doesn't work, does it? It doesn't work. It's a bit like trying to really appreciate a rose by going, right, you rose, you know. I'm really going to concentrate on you till I see how beautiful you are. Oops. Yeah, we need a light touch. We need a light touch. We need to stay relaxed, to stay open, to stay receptive to our experience, to let things happen without forcing them. So we need not too much effort and not the wrong sort of effort. We need some effort, but not too much effort, not the wrong sort of effort. And we have to teach this stuff in meditation classes all the time, so we've got loads of images we use. You've probably heard them all, but never mind. One we use is it's like holding a bird. It's like holding a bird, a living small bird in your hand. That's the sort of way you need to hold your attention, your effort. Too much, and the bird gets very unhappy, and you cause it considerable suffering. Too little, and oof, away it's gone, away it's gone. So that's quite a nice image, isn't it? The bird. Another image that sometimes used, it comes out of a book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And he says in that book, if you want your horse or cow to settle down in the meadow, give it a long lead. I don't know, maybe they do that in Japan. Maybe they put cows and horses on the lead. So he's talking about having an animal on a tether. And he's saying, well, okay, if you've got a horse or a cow and you want to keep it, or a bullock or something, if you want to keep it in the field, well, if you put it on a really short tether, well, it's just going to get frantic, actually. It's just going to get really, you know, uptight about this. And it's going to pull. It'll probably pull the thing out of the ground. Or at the very least, it's not going to settle down. It's going to be quite an unhappy animal. On the other hand, if you don't tether it at all, it'll be in the next county before you can say Jack Robinson. Somebody else will be saying, no, what do you mean it's your cow? You know, it's my cow, I've had it. But if we give the cow or the horse a long tether, well, it can't actually escape, but it doesn't feel like stressed and sort of overly confined. And it sort of wanders around a bit and then it settles down. So that's a sort of illustration, if you like, of balanced effort. And then another one that I owe to Amoghavangsa, which is very Amoghavangsa one, is that the mind is like a puppy. The mind is like a puppy. If you want to get your puppy to settle down, do not grab hold of it and get it by your side and think, now stay there. And if it misbehaves, shout at it. But very often that's how we behave with our mind. If you do that, your puppy will be squirming, it will be trying to get out there, it will be dashing around, it will be barking, it'll be doing all sorts of things. That's not going to work. That's too much effort. That's not balanced effort. If you want to get your puppy to settle down, well, you can't just let it do what it wants. Be firm when it wants to chew your shoes. Do that kindly. Speak to it kindly. Say, no, please don't, you know. You need to speak to it kindly, but be firm with it, stroke it, quiet it. The mind is just the same. And these analogies, well, they bring out something. They bring out something about the quality of our attention, the quality of the effort, and the quality of the awareness that we need in meditation. If we're holding something delicate and precious and beautiful in our hands, well, we need to hold it a bit of love, actually, a bit of appreciation. If we're holding a bird in our hands, we need to hold it with a bit of love. If we're trying to get a puppy to settle down, we need to do that with love. We need to actually like these things. If you don't like your puppy, it's going to go mad. If you just disapprove of it, it's going to go mad. Meditation is appreciating something beautiful. We need to bring some warmth and liking to it. Some warmth and liking of the present moment. We need to appreciate, like the present moment, like our mind. Appreciative attention. Yeah? Appreciative, warm attention. If we try and meditate with a cold, unappreciative attention, well, we might stay with the formal practice. We won't really be meditating. Like staring, well, I use the analogy of a rose, like staring at a painting, thinking, I'm going to stay with this painting. But hey, you're not going to appreciate the painting that way, or a tree. If you don't have some sense of appreciation, of warmth towards it, well, you're not going to like it. You're just going to focus on it in this sort of cold way. And if we try and do that in meditation, well, most likely, we'll just... It's unpleasant, so our mind will just stop. We'll just be anywhere. We'll probably drift off. But we might, if we're really strong-willed, we might just manage to do this for 40 minutes or 20 minutes, just really sort of stay with it in this willful, harsh way. But it will be quite unpleasant, actually. It'll be quite unpleasant. So in the mudra, we're holding the miraculous, beautiful present moment with kindness and awareness in our attention. As with the puppy, we need to be kind to it. As with the bird, we need to be kind to it if we want it to settle down comfortably. But very often, I mean, for some reason, we often seem to be quite harsh. We can start at one level just cold in our attention to ourselves, or even harsh, or even condemnatory, even quite condemnatory. Oh, I can't do this. So we need to work, probably most of us, on having this sort of kindly attention to ourselves. A few ideas about that I would just throw out about how we work on having this sort of quality of kindly attention. One is to develop it in general, develop an ability to appreciate things in general. So practice appreciating beauty in general. Practice appreciating nature. Just looking at it and appreciating it. Practice appreciating people. Practice appreciating art of all sorts, music, visual arts, whatever. That's one idea. Practice appreciating. The second one would be, don't set up some idealistic idea of what we should be achieving in meditation. And then be like the angry boss whose employee hasn't achieved what he should, yeah, with ourselves. So So that's something that I think we can do. We set up this sort of achievement orientation. I want to get somewhere. And the last one is, if the awareness we bring to meditation does tend to be a bit cold or harsh, do the metta bhavana. Do it. Yeah? I mean, sometimes we sort of forget about doing metta bhavana. Do the metta bhavana. Do the metta bhavana. Doing the metta bhavana is probably the best way to improve your mindfulness of breathing. Zen saying for you. Because it will help to have this sort of appreciative awareness. So just that's a bit about appreciative awareness. I'd just like to come back to the idea of balanced effort. The Buddha also used, and we've come up with these analogies of birds and puppies and things. The Buddha used an analogy of tuning a musical instrument. There was a chap called Sona who was a musician. He's recorded in the Pali Canon. A chap called Sona was a musician who came to the Buddha saying he was getting nowhere with his meditation. And the Buddha was very perceptive about people. He could immediately see what people were doing, what they were like, and what they needed. And he spotted that Sona was like making too much of the wrong sort of effort. And he used the analogy of tuning a lute, or something like a lute, whatever they had that was like lutes at the time of the Buddha. And he questioned Sona about what Sona knew about. Yeah, he questioned Sona about music. And he got him to apply what he already knew in the field of music to what he didn't know in the field of meditation. So he questioned him how to make beautiful music with a lute. And he got him to reason out from scratch, to come up with himself, that you can't make beautiful music with a lute or in meditation if the strings are either too loose, in which case the music or the meditation is flabby and floppy. And you can't make beautiful music or meditation if the strings are too tight, because then the sound comes out painful, jarring, unpleasant. Sona took away the lesson that he was tuning the instrument of his meditation too tight, if you like, that it was going ding, boop, and it was all quite unpleasant and coarse. That he needed to relax, lighten up, not be so forced, not be so willful. That was the right lesson. That was obviously the right lesson for Sona. I think it's recorded. It worked for him. And maybe it's the right lesson for you. So maybe that's the right lesson for you. Maybe that's what you need to know. Maybe your meditation is too tight and too forced and too willful. So you stay with the practice. Yeah, you know, you've been with the practice all the time, but you don't enjoy it or get much out of it. Maybe you end up feeling a bit stiff and tense. So you need to relax. You need to relax a bit. Not grab at the breath quite so hard. Open up to other aspects of what's going on. Make your attention more appreciative, warmer, kinder. Maybe, on the other hand, you need the opposite. Maybe you make too little effort, so you drift for long spells without coming back to the body or the practice. You daydream, and then you finish, and you sort of think, oh, where did the time go? Have we finished already? So maybe then you need to make more effort in your practice. Tighten up a bit, sharpen up a bit. Keep a clearer, tighter focus on the breath. So unless things are going really well, most of us need to do one or the other. Meditation is a bit like a balancing act. It's very, very difficult to be absolutely right. We're usually one side or the other. We usually need to either tighten up our attention or relax a bit. And becoming aware of that, sort of becoming mindful of that, learning to work with our minds is one of the benefits of meditation. It's not just about getting somewhere in the future. It's about learning to be aware, learning about ourselves, learning about how to work with our minds. This learning about balanced effort is one aspect of that. So we need to ask ourselves, which way am I generally? am I generally a bit too, or am I generally a bit too of a sort of military in my approach? And when we're meditating, we need to ask ourselves, well, which way am I now? Which way am I now? That's part of the discipline of meditating. Do I need to lighten up? Do I need to tighten up? And actually, the meditation mudra can be quite a practical way. Using the meditation mudra can actually be quite a practical way of becoming aware of whether our effort is too tight or too loose. Because the way we are is reflected in our physical state. And if our effort is too tight, we'll tend to tighten up. And you might find, oh dear, my thumbs have gone white. This is just a factor of experience. You can sit there in the meditation mudra and after, oh dear, look. So that's we're holding the bird too tight. The bird's going to be quite distressed. The bubble is going to burst. The present moment is not going to be pleasant. We've got the wrong sort of effort. It's too willed. On the other hand, we might find that thumbs sort of drift apart and sort of hands sort of... And then the bird is gone. The bird's flown. The bubble has floated away and been blown away by the wind. We've got not enough effort. We've just lost it. We've lost it. We've drifted. So actually using the meditation mudra, in meditation can be quite a good way of gauging whether I need to relax or do I need to just sharpen up. This is a suggestion, try using the mudra in that way. I'll say a bit more about this later. Try using it. Use the whole body and the whole posture of the Buddha, perhaps. Keep coming back to the body. Keep grounding your awareness in the reality of the body. Use the body as a guide. So that's one thing, is use the body as a guide. If you're slumping, your head has fallen forward, your shoulders have gone round, you're slumped against the back of the chair, too little effort, tighten up. Sharpen up, sit straight, take a firmer hold on the breath. If your back's stiff, your shoulders are raised, your chin is stuck out, all sorts of things like that. Your jaw is tight, your face is tight, your eyes are tight, your temples are sort of a bit as though there's a band around them. Settle down, relax a bit. Rest your attention on it gently, as though your mind were holding a bird. Stroking a puppy. So maybe if you're like that, maybe just have. I've came across one teacher of meditation who said, "Well, have 25% of your attention on the breath. Yeah? Keep a continuity of awareness. 25% of your attention on the breath. Some attention on the body, letting other things, broadening it out, broadening the awareness out, letting other things happen, but keeping that sort of thread of continuity." Make it light. Stroke the puppy. Don't grab hold of it. At this point, so I'm going to say that we all need to be doing one or the other, lightening up a bit or tightening up a bit. And at this point, somebody usually says, I'm both. When I meditate, I both feel tight and tense, and I completely lose the practice. And that usually completely throws me. But you're not throwing me this time, because I've thought about it in advance, okay? I'm ready. If that is you, the chances are that you're in the grip of one of the hindrances, okay? So we've probably all heard about the hindrances to meditation. Desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, anxiety and restlessness, and indecision, doubt and indecision. So these are mental habits. They're mental habits that operate all the time. They operate in our life. They operate all the time, so they operate in meditation. They come up when we meditate. And the first step in meditation is to get beyond them. The first step, read what the Buddha has to say about this. The first step is get beyond the hindrances. And often the way to do that is to look at how we encourage the hindrances in everyday life. So if we spend our time outside being irritable and resentful, but it's not going to be surprising if we get some ill will in meditation. If we spend our time outside gratifying, in a constant search to gratify our sensory desires, stoking them up, well, they're going to come up in meditation. We're going to be dissatisfied when there's nothing to eat or screw or something like that. Or touch or something, If we don't make clear decisions and commit ourselves in everyday life, well, we drift about in a sort of anxious fog when we meditate. So if we are firmly in the grip of the one hindrances, you're quite likely to be both tense and away with the pixies as far as your meditation practice is concerned in some other place. That's quite likely, actually. If you're in the grip of ill will, well, you will feel tense, but you won't be meditating. If you're in the grip of indecision, you will feel anxious, but you won't be meditating. So, in a sense, that this we need to look at balanced effort. The need to look at balanced effort comes after the need to deal with the hindrances, in a way. At least the grossest manifestations of the hindrances, that's what we need to look at first. It's almost as though balanced effort is a slightly more advanced practice. For once, we've managed to get beyond the hindrances at least some of the time. And I can't say everything there is to say about meditation in one talk, so I'm not going to talk about the hindrances. Go and look at your beginner's notes and find a book on meditation, because they've all got it in it. Or talk to an order member. But if we thought about it in terms of the gesture of meditation, before we can take up the gesture of meditation, we need to put down the baggage we're carrying in our hands, the baggage we brought to meditation, get rid of the hindrances, then we can think about the practice. So let's return to the meditation mudra, as I'm going to suggest we might do in our meditation. Just one last thing about it. It's often associated with a particular Buddha, the Buddha Amitabha. So there's lots of aspects of enlightenment, as we've said, and one of the things that's happened over as Buddhism evolved was that different archetypal images evolved, different archetypal figures emerged that represent aspects of enlightenment. And one of these is the Buddha Amitabha, the Buddha of the West, who is also shown in with the meditation mudra, and he's also the Buddha associated with sunset, with colour red and sunset. And I don't think this is a... I think this connection between meditation and sunset is not an accident. If you spend some time outdoors in nature, actually living outdoors in nature, rather than in a house, you'll notice something very marked happens at sunset. A marked change in the atmosphere. In the human realm, the bustle of the day is over and we can, there's nothing to do but relax and maybe enjoy the spectacle of the setting sun. But then the birds and the animals go quiet and settle down for the night. And deep peace seems to settle over the whole of nature. And even the inanimate world seems to join in. Often the wind drops. I don't know why it does, but a wind drops and to nothing and everything becomes really calm while the sky puts on this amazing light show and the round red sun just hovers on the edge of the world. It's as though a natural sort of meditative state sort of descends on the mind of the whole world at sunset if you're really out in it. And we're sort of drawn into the state of calm and peace. And it's associated with this round setting sun, so we could sort of envisage this round setting sun, holding the round setting sun, or even holding the peace of the sunset, holding the experience of sunsets that we've had in the past. Well, anyway, it works for me. It might not work for you. But there is something about... Remembering what that feels like. So that's just another little association, maybe, from this mudra. This round mudra. Which could be all the things we've talked about. So I'm going to, as a final sort of parting suggestion, I'm going to suggest, humbly invite you to try using the gesture of meditation when you meditate, at least as an experiment. So one of the things about meditation, especially something like the mindfulness of breathing, we need to anchor it in the body. We need to keep coming back to the body. The body is the sort of basis from which we build our mindfulness. And doing something special with our body helps this. If you read a lot of Zen practitioners, they make something very big about taking up the meditation posture. But they mean it in terms of like proper lotus position or half lotus position. They make a very big thing about that. But having a special position, like sitting in half lotus or even cross-legged that we don't normally do, can do that. It's sort of reminder that there's something special going on. It's a reminder to the unconscious that there's something special going on. Helps us to come back to the body. Okay, well, we might not sit in any special position. We might sit in a chair. But if we make the mudra, we're still doing something special with our body. We're still doing something that reminds our unconscious that we're meditating, that recalls the meditative state, sort of creates a continuity between different meditations that we've done, and that calls us back to the body, that reminds us to come back to the body. And it's particularly good to use the hands. If we're going to do something to anchor ourselves in the body, it's particularly good to use the hands, actually, because the hands have got tons of nerve endings. If you've ever seen, saw somewhere a chart of actually where our sensation is as human beings, it's to do with where our nerve endings are. And it's like, if you pictured the body as we experience it, our hands are huge, and our lips are huge, and like the rest of us is quite small. So our hands are huge. Our hands are huge in our awareness. They're a huge part of our awareness because there's so many nerve endings in them. So our hands are a big part of our experience of the body. So try it. Try using the mudra. Try connecting with the idea of holding something very beautiful and very fragile. Maybe a soap bubble. Maybe holding the present moment beautifully. And come back to the hands, then come back to the hands in meditation. Whenever you drift, come back to the hands, then the body, then the breathing. Between stages, come back to the hands. How are they? How is my body? Back to the breathing. And maybe more often. I mean, you could actually come back to the hands at each breath, if you like. We sit here with the hands in front of the abdomen. You can follow the breath in, down, to behind the hands, connect with the hands, the breath goes back up and out. Very often it's quite a good thing to follow the breath down quite deep in the body, it's sort of very grounding. You can use the fact that the hands are held like this as a sort of guide. The breath every time reminds us of the hands, goes back out again, comes in, reminds us of the hands. So you might want to try that. Follow the breath down to the hands, up and out again. Help us to anchor our experience in the body. And try using the hands as a bit of a guide to our balanced effort. Are they like this or are they like that? If you actually take on board, I'm going to keep the gesture of meditation. Well, am I too tight or have I lost it? You know, it can be a guide to that. When you come back to the hands, you'll also have a guide to do I need to tighten up or do I need to relax? So my suggestion is try this as an experiment and see where you get with it. Even if you revert to having your hands in your usual position afterwards, you might find that you get something from the experiment. Okay? You might really find that it works for you. So that's a little bit about the gesture of meditation. Somebody said to me earlier, how can you possibly talk 40 minutes about the gesture of meditation?